Exodus chapter 20 is the giving of the law. It's the giving of the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. Be the first one of those. Second being, you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything. And the list goes on. You know the ten. Chapters 21, 22, and 23 kind of fill in some gaps of behavior. The protection of the community in the midst of their property, the responsibility socially as the community lives its life together, making sure we pay attention to the issues of justice and mercy, honoring the Sabbath, having us pay attention to the festivals that remind us of the grace of God. This is simply, here's how you're going to live as you begin to walk together. They've done it for a little bit. They haven't done very well. So now here's some boundaries. This is kind of the parent putting the chore chart on the door. It's written now. Please follow this. And in chapter 24, God says to Moses, grab the elders and worship and approach the people and ask them, are you going to follow through with this? To which the people responded, it says, with one voice, everything the Lord has said, we will do. And Moses then, in chapter 24, goes up to the mountain, into the cloud, for which he would remain there for 40 days. The giving of the instructions, the folks saying, we'll do it. And I can't help but put this in the context of what I'm going through as a father. Like, Dad, I'll do it. And then Moses steps away into the cloud. And chapter 32 hits. There's a lot of instructions given to Moses while he's up on the mountain for 40 days. A lot of it related to worship and the consecration of a worship space and its people. And 32 comes about. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. Oh, how quickly. The first commandment is, I am the Lord your God. And they say, we want gods. We're out of the gate in a bad way. We want multiple gods, not the one true God. That's an interesting translation as well. As for this guy Moses, this fellow who they've watched stand in front of the people on behalf of God in pretty remarkable ways, he's lost. He's gone. We don't think he's going to come back. The distancing is already unfolding. So Aaron, who is Moses' brother, the chief priest, the leader of the worship, doesn't say, okay, let's hold horses here. Let's pause for a moment. I mean, the first thing he says, okay, let's do this. Take off the gold earrings that your wives and your sons and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. So all the people took their earrings and brought them to Aaron, and he took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then he said, as he's pointing to one thing, these are your gods who brought you up out of Egypt. I I hope just the text is beginning to paint the picture of what's going on. The instructions were given. I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt. Well, how do we know that? Did you see water rise as you were walking? Did you see the plagues unfolding in ways that the Egyptian magicians could never master? Did you see the provision of manna in the desert when you thought there was no food? Did you see water come pouring out of the top of a rock? I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt. They fashioned a golden calf, said these are our gods, and these are the things that brought us up out of Egypt. We've talked a little bit about on this wilderness journey, and we're doing a sermon series on Exodus, the wilderness journey. And a lot of the things that have come upon the people have been related to felt needs, right? You've got this, you need help in the journey, you're thirsty, and the thirst makes you crazy and makes you do stupid things. You're hungry and you're a grumbler, and God all along has been providing for them at their base needs. He's protecting them from outside attacks. He's given them food. He's given them water. This is really the first place, though, that kind of exposes something that's not outside of us. Because we often look at the wilderness journey as being one in which the circumstances we encounter are the things that are prohibiting us from moving forward. It's the dryness of the desert. It's the heat that's baking us. It's the inability to find food and water. It's the real unknown of a dangerous place to be walking through. That is to say, the wilderness we see is what we look in front of us and say, that is kind of an obstacle for my life. How do I make it through? This is really exposing the greatest of obstacles is one within us. That in the wilderness journey, it's not simply things that come our way that really provide problems for us. At the heart of it is who we are inside. What we choose to do when circumstances go poorly. Now, I can't judge my boys too harshly because I know what I did when my parents left the room. We fought. We damaged things in the home. We said things we wish we wouldn't have said. And the Onsager boys were taught a very dangerous love of fire. That I'm very thankful that my parents' home is still standing. So, the Israelites were left to themselves after being given from God, whose presence is right there in front of them, the powerful nature of God's presence surrounding in a cloud, Mount Sinai, this powerful mountain, is still the backdrop for them losing it all once Moses goes up the hill. And the biggest thing to be exposed here, of course, that they engage in revelry, they engage in misbehavior as they're up on the hill, but it's all framed and fashioned after one big problem. It's the problem that the Bible names idolatry. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. I think that would have been a great place to stop on the idolatry question, but God adds to it a second command. Don't make an idol. You shall have no other gods, plural, before me. I am it. And also don't make what you think I am. Don't form it, don't fashion it. The first two are all about this problem. Why is this? Why is it this way? It's actually very simple because it's very much a part of our nature, is that we want to form and fashion a life for ourselves that has no obstacles. We want to really have a life without the parents around. And yet what happens when the parents leave? They're not around. You think they're going to eat food that's healthy for them when they raid the fridge? No. When I see my kids sick, it's usually because I've been away writing or reading in the other room, and the entire bag of cookies is gone. They just don't stop. There's just no filling up on the junk. In the text in Exodus 32, it's far more serious than this, but you get this, the point of the damage that can be done when you think that what's best for you is defined by you. And in much of the same way as we want to form and fashion a parent that we think we would like to have raising us, this is exactly what the people are doing in this text. What kind of God do we think we want? What kind of God should we worship? What kind of gods can help us out in various phases of our lives? And I know that we are kind of much removed from the kind of culture that forms something in gold or steel and bows down and prays to it or worships it. But what's unfolding here is the exact same motivation in our own lives, that we actually maybe visually or mentally form an idea of what we think God should be, the kind of character traits that he should unfold and live by, that the kind of things he would permit us to do if he just didn't get in our way. And we worship our images of what God should be, or we think he should be for us. We're at the men's retreat this past weekend. It was entitled Iconic. So the Greek word is icon, and as Jesus Christ is the icon of God. He is the image of God. And I raised a point in there that when you start asking the question, what kind of image do you have of God? It does end up leading to a God that we prefer or like. I've watched a lot of Jesus movies over the years. You know, you can go, I remember being in, I think, 4 years old and going to a movie theater in Dillon, Montana to watch Jesus of Nazareth. I watched some clips of it recently. This is the British blue-eyed Jesus, who is very, the man never smiles, let's just put it that way, in the show. Powerful in his speeches with respect to the Sermon on the Mount, but almost like an old sage of wisdom. Many of you have seen The Passion of the Christ, and you see very much framed and fashioned after a Jewish look, Jewish Messiah. Of course, that's very intense in its portrayal of the death. The Jesus Show in 1999, which is a movie on TV. You watch clips of that. This is the American Jesus. Got kind of, he looks like he just came off the beach at Santa Cruz. But in this movie, he laughs and he dances. Jesus can't do that. or so we think. But why not? But I found myself reflecting on a lot of these things, thinking, which Jesus do I like? Which Jesus in the movie speaks to me more? Scripture wants to tell us, and I'm not actually critiquing, I suppose, a cinematography, a representation of Jesus, but the danger is that we can kind of, it is the Jesus as portrayed by the director who's trying to evoke in the audience a certain kind of feeling. And Scripture wants to tell us to be careful about trying to make a God in your own image. Things that you really identify with, you attach yourself to, saying, you know, I like that. The God that we are called to understand is the God of Scripture, who defines himself. He shows us who he is. We listen to what he says about himself. And we listen to the parameters that he provides us for the life that we are called to live, and it has a lot of truth and a lot of grace in it, and both at times will make us bristle. Because he extends grace in ways that we probably would say, I wouldn't show grace in that situation. But he also shows and delivers truth at times where we think, you know what, it's not the truth of my culture, it's not the truth of my society, it's not the truth that I want to live my life by, and it challenges us to stay in the life he has designed. But he's the one who gets to decide. He is the one who calls for our allegiance to who he reveals himself to be and our commitment to follow what he's asked us to listen to. And his end goal is for us to do it willingly, not merely by the presence of that cloud constantly, as it were, in our room or everywhere we go, looking over our shoulder. Will we trust in God as he presents himself to us, or will we trust in the gods of our own making? Don't think for a minute this is still not a problem, because it very much is. We continue to make idols of the things that we worship, from money and power and success. And we form and fashion images of God that we think, that we really think will make us happy, only to show us in the end that they do great damage to our lives. We make the decisions that we do, make us very sick when we are rejecting the good, healthy food that he offers us in his word. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. I am the water of life. We are meant to follow him. There's a parallel to Exodus 32 and 1 Corinthians 10. And it kind of wraps up the entire Exodus journey in this, but it's a great way to look at it right now in light of really an epic fail in Exodus chapter 32. Actually, I'm going to do one thing before I get there. I forgot about this one. Moses comes down the mountain and sees the mess going on. They have been worshiping the Lord. Now it's a big party. It's a big revelry. It's a big experience of living their lives that they want to. And Moses says this to his brother. What did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin? And Aaron responds, do not be angry, my Lord. You know how prone these people are to evil. You know how prone they are to evil. They said to me, make gods who will go before us. But as for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. So I told them, whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off. Then they gave me the gold, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. I mean, there are so many parallel examples to my children. It just was what happened. Is this not, I mean, an exposure of our real propensity to succumb to temptation? They wanted gods. Aaron enjoyed being in power, and he folded like a deck of cards. And it was on his shoulders for what he said, but they're all in this together. The temptation overcame them. And so you might be thinking, what are we getting to in the midst of this text? Is that we have to expose the temptations that will really bring us down. And the big one, of course, is idolatry. But also to recognize that we're all in this together, and it's not something that we're going to master. It's actually whose power and whose strength are we going to rely on when the temptations are great. So the Apostle Paul says this to a church in Corinth, who, by the way, I've said this before, Corinth, I've heard many sermon series entitled Christians Gone Wild as the letter to 1 Corinthians. It's really a church that's got a lot of problems. They're getting the gospel wrong. It's a real mess. A lot of power issues and struggles going on, a lot of bad theology, a lot of immorality unfolding into it. Paul wants to say this to a church he's kind of mad at. If you read 1 Corinthians, he's like, knock this off. He says this. Let's have it in your bulletin on page 5. I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud, and they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food. They drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and the rock was Christ. They were all in this together. All their eyes saw the same thing.